to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman. Today, we'd really like to thank our sponsor, Milan Laser. You guys, PCOS Awareness Month is here in September, and we're talking about it on one of our podcasts this month, but about 70% of women living with polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS, develop irregular hair growth on their upper lip, chin, neck, sides of their face, back, all over their body. But there's options out there to help patients get the confidence that they deserve. So laser hair removal is the best treatment for women with PCOS hair growth. And this podcast is all about using medical expertise to help other people, which is why I love Milan Laser Hair Removal. They were founded by a board-certified physician. Their providers are medical professionals. At Milan Laser, you can expect a respectful, judgment-free environment with safe, effective treatments. Milan Laser has over 135 locations nationwide. Because laser hair removal is their sole focus, you'll always have superior guidance to achieve your best results. And because hormone fluctuations are common with PCOS, Milan Laser guarantees your results with their exclusive unlimited package. It's included at no extra cost, and there's no more paying for touch-up fees ever. They're really the greatest choice for women with PCOS and unwanted hair. Milan Laser is also a gold corporate sponsor of this year's PCOS conference. It's going on September 17th through the 20th, and they have been a proud sponsor of the PCOS Awareness Association since 2019. So if you're ready to get hair-free skin of your dreams, just give Milan Laser a call. It's 833-NO-RAZOR or visit milanlaser.com today. You can use my code FITANDFAB60. You guys, that's FITANDFAB, FITANDFAB60, to get 60% off any body area, including, get ready for this, the full body purchase, which is awesome. So that's FITANDFAB60, all one word. Thank you to Milan Laser. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Jamie. Welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. Thanks for listening to all of our previous episodes, downloading on Apple Podcasts, leaving all your reviews on Apple Podcasts, sharing your comments and questions on YouTube. We really appreciate our followers. And the more you interact with us, the more we can get seen and get these important messages out to more people. Well, I have a very special guest today on the podcast, Dr. Abigail Delaney. I went to residency with Dr. Delaney, so she's a very dear friend of mine and practices here in my town in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. So we get to interact with each other quite a bit. But September is PCOS Awareness Month, and so I thought this was just such a great opportunity to bring her on the show and talk about PCOS because, as many of you know, I have my own personal story with PCOS. Was missing periods, having trouble losing weight, having trouble getting pregnant with my first daughter, went on metformin, had a prescription for Clomid in my hand, and was luckily able to get pregnant, I think because I was on an away rotation in the middle of Nebraska eating lettuce and cottage cheese. But nutrition now these days is a whole different story, but it all worked out. It all worked out. But I was a medical student back then and super naive and didn't, you know, really understand what PCOS really was and how to manage it. And I think it is kind of a strange disease with a lot of myths and things out there. So Dr. Delaney, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's so exciting to have you here. So tell people who you are, okay, what you do for a living, a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Okay. So as Dr. Jamie said, I am Abby Delaney. I'm born and raised Nebraska.
Go just big like red.
Jamie, go big red. So I'm from a little suburb in Millard here. I did my medical school and residency at the University of Nebraska, a medical center just like Jamie. And then I went off to Mayo Clinic for a fellowship with a one-year stint in there at the University of Louisville. So I'm a reproductive endocrinologist, as Jamie alluded to, with kind of primary specialty in infertility. So my job is to get people pregnant and then send them back to Jamie for her to deliver. And so I would say that PCOS is certainly, I would say probably 50% of our patients.
It's crazy. Yeah. I just think when I look at the literature, all the time, I'm like, the percentages they report, I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I think it's higher than that. And it's such a spectrum of disease that I think it's really hard to define. Sometimes, patients really they want the diagnosis, and sometimes it can be subtle or it's just not clear. So I want to talk about how to define it, but to back up for 2 seconds. So Dr. Delaney works as an REI doctor, reproductive endocrinology and infertility. So how that works is she went to medical school, she graduated, she did a full 4 years of obstetrics and gynecology. And then I went off into private practice world, didn't pursue fellowship. So Dr. Delaney went on and did additional training, 3 years, right? REI is 3 years at Mayo Clinic. So this is 3 years of additional training beyond general obstetrics and gynecology to focus on helping women achieve pregnancy. So tell us what PCOS is and like how we define it, because I think this is one of the most confusing things for all the Instagram followers and people out there who wonder if they have it.
Well, first, let me start with a medical diagnosis, and then let me sort of kind of carry it over to how I describe it to patients, because it's kind of confusing, and you're right. I think the first thing to know is that there's this huge spectrum of PCOS. There are patients that have polycystic ovaries that are rail thin, skinny, and are hyper exercisers. There are patients with PCOS that are kind of fit the more classic phenotype, morbidly obese, predisposed for type 2 diabetes, and everything in between. And so in order to diagnose it, you have to have sort of this like wide spectrum. And so there's lots of different criteria. I think most of us in the OBGYN and REI world use the Rotterdam criteria, which is this sort of the medical definition. So you have to have 2 out of 3 of the following criteria. And the 3 criteria are: you can have irregular menstrual cycles. And generally speaking, that is less than 25 or greater than 35 days per month. So abnormal uterine bleeding, essentially. Either signs of androgen excess, so, you know, male patterned kind of hair growth on your face, chin, neck, chest, or you can have polycystic ovaries on ultrasound. And that criteria has been sort of subtly modified in the last few years, but I still use sort of the old school PCOS, where you have greater than 12 follicles on ultrasound per ovary. So that is like the medical version.
Which I think is so confusing, because like, here's how I see it clinically. First of all, nobody's ultrasounding their ovaries at home. At least I hope you're not.
Well, that'd be hard.
but they had some ER visit and they had a cyst on their ovary. Yeah. And now, doctor, do I have polycystic ovaries? I'm prone to cysts. So for everybody out there listening, the ovary's job is to make cysts. Like every single month in an ovulatory patient, these follicles are getting recruited. You make a dominant follicle. In a perfect world, you ovulate. It turns into a corpus luteum, and then it regresses, and then the cycle starts all over again. So the ovary's job is to make cysts. It's normal to have little cysts on your ovaries. So when they're looking, Abby, at, you know, when you're scanning a patient, like what actually sonographically does a polycystic ovary actually look like? Like, why is it different than a normal ovary that has cysts?
Right. So like I said, so we're looking at, when we look at an ovary, typically you can think of an ovary like a cookie. And they kind of, the old montage is that a PCOS ovary always looks like the chocolate chips are on the outside of the ovary. So they sort of kind of line the outside. And the idea is that the ovary has 2 parts. There's the follicular part and there's a stromal part, which is a lot of where the male hormones are kind of released. And in women with PCOS, that stromal part is a lot bigger. So the inside of the ovary is a lot bigger than the outside. And so that is sort of the classic polycystic appearance.
So the ovaries are larger, like the volume is larger.
Correct. Yeah. The volume is larger. And then the, I guess, orientation of how the follicles kind of are placed is
right. Unique. Okay. And so then going to the other criteria, and I'm just literally highlighting for all of you why I think this is such a confusing disease, even for, you know, patients. So then this other criteria of Rotterdam is, you know, hyperandrogenism. So we're talking like hair growth, acne. I mean, acne is so common,
Right.
I mean, all the time. Right. Yes. So I think that's a hard one. The hair growth, I've even had patients that have, you know, hair growth, but then, you know, biochemically speaking, their androgen levels are normal. Oh, yeah. So I don't know, maybe is this just their heritage, you know? And then when it comes to periods, there are so many reasons why people can have missed periods, irregular periods, Or patients come to me on, hey, I've been on birth control pills for 19 years, but I think I have PCOS. Like, so I think that's why it's so confusing for patients. Because when we talk about something like Rotterdam criteria, it's like a woman who's not on any medications, she's, you know, normally cycling and has, you know, XYZ symptoms and, you know, sonographic polycystic ovaries.
It's kind of one of those things in medicine where it's like, we all hope that we all fit a specific box, and clearly like it doesn't happen that way.
Ever. Yeah. There's nothing in medicine that checking the boxes. No, so yeah,
not at all.
So there's really just like no universally accepted definition of PCOS. And that's why you want to work with your doctor, get assessed, have them do a clinical examination, you know, have them perform biochemical testing and ultrasound to really kind of like define what is going on with you. And at the end of the day, I mean, like having the diagnosis of PCOS, you know, like it doesn't really matter to me, right? I feel like patients kind of like want a label for their problems, but at the end of the day, we just, you know, treat each issue.
I think that's the other thing that's important to remember too, though, that you were mentioning that you do a whole workup. I mean, PCOS is technically a diagnosis of exclusion. So what that means is that because it's such a broad diagnosis and it's so sort of diverse, you have to rule everything else out. And so, you know, a doctor shouldn't ever really like look at you and say, well, you clearly have PCOS, unless they've looked at everything. Because, you know, I've definitely seen secondhand how if a workup isn't performed, things can be missed. So definitely talk to somebody about it.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because in medical school, right, you're always trying to picture this like stereotypical patient. This is how like we memorize things. And certainly with PCOS, you know, if I walk into the room and I've got this kind of, you know, overweight woman, she's got signs of insulin resistance, she's got signs of hirsutism, you know, she might have even like a beard, you know, kind of male pattern baldness kind of thing starting. There's certainly like this phenotype. But what are the other like big conditions that should be ruled out?
Sure. So I think that most people, when they go to their doctor, and if it's a primary care doctor or their primary OBGYN, the first thing that they go to for PCOS symptoms for is generally irregular menstrual cycles. And the thing that's probably the most dangerous that I've seen people miss is that they've ruled out, or that they haven't been diagnosed with, diminished ovarian reserve. So at least evaluate ovarian reserve parameters so that you know that like there's enough eggs left, because nothing is worse than an infertility doctor where a patient comes to me and they've been labeled as PCOS this whole time, but actually they were having basically perimenopausal symptoms. But the other things that are probably more common and more important are things like thyroid disease. So classically, hypo or hyperthyroidism can cause your periods to be irregular. Hyperprolactinemia, where kind of that's the milk hormone, and that causes irregular or an erratic secretion of a brain hormone that causes your periods to be irregular. And then, you know, the whole kind of diagnosis of abnormal uterine bleeding, you would want to make sure that there's nothing structurally related with the uterus, that there isn't any polyps or fibroids or anything that could be causing a problem. But in general, I think the big three are make sure that somebody knows ovarian hormones, make sure that someone's checked thyroid, and make sure that someone has checked prolactin. And then, you know, we know from medical school, there's always these like zebras, right? So usually pounding hooves is horses, but sometimes they're a zebra, and that's things like an ovarian tumor or an adrenal tumor, which I think I've diagnosed one in my career. So
rare, but it happens. Right. Yeah, rare, but it happens. Is there genetic predisposition to PCOS?
So it's actually really interesting. The jury's out, right? So we don't really know. We do know that there does seem to be trends in women who have PCOS and then go on to have PCOS daughters. Now, what's more interesting is that that doesn't seem to be always the case. And I think that's where you get into diet, exercise, epigenetic change that I know that you've talked about a lot on your podcast and things. But I would say that there is probably a predisposition, but we're not able to sort of target a specific gene or like multiple genes. What they have found is that like if you take in animal studies and you inject mice with kind of extra testosterone or kind of male hormones, and if they're carrying female babies, a lot of those female babies have irregular menstrual cycles. So, you know, I certainly think there's something to it, but I think that it is not like 100% consistent.
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting in the next 10, 20 years, you know, what we really find out about genetics. You know, they mapped the whole human microbiome, but like they really didn't. we're still finding, you know, more and more little SNPs and things like that. And this idea that you brought up of epigenetics, I think, is so underplayed. I think we're going to find out that there's just so much influence, not only in utero, but even just the way that our bodies interact with our environment and methylation and
how
we take care of ourselves. It can turn genes off and on, essentially. Yeah. And so that can't be underplayed at all. So super important issue. Making the diagnosis. So we've kind of, you know, defined that. Now, of course, one of the big things with PCOS, and I think another reason why it's very confusing, is because these days, people with metabolic disorders is like shooting fish in a barrel. So 88% of America has abnormal metabolic markers. So I think sometimes it can be really confusing looking at a patient, like, is this person just metabolically kind of broken? Because patients with PCOS are at an increased risk of metabolic disease. So talk to me about like patients that are trying to get pregnant. Like, how does this play a role in their like workup and treatment?
So I think it's sort of, I sort of tailor kind of my approach depending on their phenotype a little bit. But here's what I will put a caveat on that. So even lean PCOS patients that are very thin and have like minimal body fat still have an element of insulin resistance. The problem is that their insulin resistance is probably significantly lower than patients who are at risk for having a higher kind of BMI and having higher fasting insulin levels. So what kind of most organizations have gone to is particularly any patient that comes to me that has obesity or are overweight by BMI standards, I do an evaluation for insulin resistance. And that's always kind of a funny topic. There's no perfect test for insulin resistance ever. You know, the book will tell you to do a 2-hour glucose tolerance test. That's not always easy to do. And our labs really struggle doing that. So I have settled on getting at least a fasting insulin and a hemoglobin A1C in these patients, as well as I generally always get a fasting glucose so that I have an idea if there's something that I can label and if there's something where I can say, yeah, there's insulin resistance there, then I do that. So as far as metabolically, that's generally what I order. But I think it's important, just like we talked about, as far as workup, I order thyroids on everybody, prolactin level. And then as far as male androgen hormones, I usually just get one set of those. Don't need to have those repeated every year or anything, but I check a testosterone and I checked a DHEAS and a 17-hydroxyprogesterone. Long story short, those just rule out those really weird things that are super, super rare, but you can feel confident in your diagnosis if they're negative.
Yeah.
So those are the things I typically do. I mean, I am lucky as a reproductive endocrinologist that my physical exam is essentially an ultrasound. So almost all of my patients have some sort of ultrasound, you know, where I'm looking at their ovaries. So I'll have that data. But that being said, those are probably the main things that I order to sort of look at everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to highlight some of the things she said, metabolic syndrome, super common in these patients, so always screening for insulin resistance, but long-term, of course, like after they're out of Dr. Delaney's office and they've had all their pregnancies, you know, really thinking long-term with people with PCOS on an annual basis, you want to know what your fasting glucose is, what your fasting insulin is, what your A1C is, what your triglycerides are, what your blood pressure is, what your waist circumference is. I mean, these things are super important just for long-term health because we know that patients with PCOS are at an increased risk for those things and for complications in pregnancy. So not only infertility, but gestational diabetes. So my listeners know, I just think it's preconception visits are definitely underutilized. And I think that's some of the problem with PCOS patients is they were diagnosed at a younger age. They got placed on oral contraceptive pills just to fix their problems. And now they want to get pregnant and they come off the pills and they're not having periods. And so then it's kind of confusing trying to make the diagnosis because what birth control pills do is they can bind up some of the free testosterone. So they might've been making some of the androgenic symptoms better. Obviously it was covering up the problem with the period. So then sometimes it's really just kind of, you know, really teasing out what the issue is. So if there's somebody out there who has been given a diagnosis of PCOS, what advice do you have for them from a preconception standpoint, knowing that they have higher rates of infertility?
Yeah. So, well, I think the first thing is taking care of yourself, right? So PCOS, number one, I would say make sure you do whatever you can to get your weight under the best control it can be, right? So, you know, specifically if you are obese at this time, if you can lose up to 10% of your body weight, fertility rates are much higher. I I think it's really important that if you, like I said, if you are overweight, that you should talk to your daughter or talk to your doctor about getting insulin levels. I think that, you know, it may be something where you need to be put on metformin. It may be something where there is some medication that can sort of help you through that kind of insulin resistance period in addition to diet. And so I think those are sort of the things, like if you're trying to get pregnant, those are the things that I would want you to do, is really sort of work on yourself. I think the other thing is that the diagnosis comes with a lot of depression. Like mm-hmm. it's depression. It's higher in women with PCOS because it's hard. And I think there's a big stigma with like needing help to get pregnant. I think a lot of women, when we're, you know, born and grow up, it's this idea that, you know, I was made to create babies. And mm-hmm. so, you know, getting that help is hard to sort of swallow. And I think it's especially hard, particularly in women with PCOS that have done the work, right? They've lost the weight. They've done everything, like as far as all of their metabolic parameters look much better, and they're still not having regular cycles and they need some assistance getting pregnant. And that is just not, it's okay. Like you just have to sort of accept that and recognize that you are doing everything right. And
yeah.
you just have to sort of keep going and recognize that, you know, when you have high blood pressure, you do diet and weight loss. And if it doesn't work, you put on a pill because that lowers your blood pressure. And it's the same thing with fertility. You know, you do everything you can, you try to control everything you possibly can. And then once you've sort of lost that control, then, you know, you just need to ask for help and that's okay.
Yeah. And like, that's where Western medicine shines, is like for the people that have maximized lifestyle intervention and they need help. And that's right. like what we're here for. The unfortunate part is there's a lot of people that don't want to do the work, but they become more complicated patients. So let's dive just like a little bit into the science of PCOS more. So we keep talking about this word of insulin resistance. Can you talk about like just the pathophysiology? Like sure. why is insulin resistance like kind of at the root of this problem?
Right.
Like how does it make things worse?
So, well, first of all, so I kind of describe all of my, to all of my patients that PCOS is kind of like having a date in a loud bar. There's a lot of noise, right? So in women who have regular menstrual cycles every single month and regularly cycle, release an egg, and have a normal period, there's this highly coordinated event between the brain and the ovary and then the uterus subsequently to kind of either allow a pregnancy to take or have a period. Unfortunately, with PCOS, because there are all of these extra things that are secreted by those ovaries, or they're secreted by kind of the extra adipose tissue that a lot of patients with PCOS carry around, what we run into is that those normal signals from the brain and the ovary, they can't communicate effectively, right? And so the polycystic ovary secretes extra testosterone. It secretes extra growth hormone, which further increases insulin levels. And so the problem is that there's all this extra floating insulin, and then it makes subtle changes on the insulin receptor so that that insulin that you have isn't even being effective. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the way that I describe it. It's basically like there's a lot of noise and there's not enough communication between the brain and the ovary. The medications that are used to sort of tackle kind of the multifaceted kind of physiologic changes that we see with PCOS are designed to sort of kind of piece those apart, if you will. Mm-hmm.
So when I'm doing testing on patients, you know, we're looking at FSH, LH levels, so follicle stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone secreted from the pituitary gland. So we see disturbances, you know, higher, you know, LH due to the androgen secretion. And then another lab that not all doctors check, which is unfortunate, but anti-Müllerian hormone or AMH, which right. Dr. Delaney had touched on earlier, really like knowing what a patient's ovarian reserve is and making sure this patient isn't, you know, perimenopausal or premature ovarian failure. Can you talk about why PCOS patients sometimes have really sky-high AMHs?
So AMH is a hormone that is secreted by the granulosa cells that surround follicles. And because there's a lot of follicles in PCOS, there's more granulosa cells. And so the higher that number, the more eggs you have. Now, what's interesting about PCOS, and they haven't adopted AMH as right now, I mean, like, you know, scientific committee, they haven't diagnosed someone. You can't diagnose someone for PCOS based on AMH.
Just off AMH, yeah.
But what we do know is that the higher the AMH, the kind of significant increased risk of, you know, having resistance to the medications, the more difficult it is to get pregnant. And so that is how AMH sort of comes into play. But it can be sort of for patients that are just seeing a primary care doctor, you know, generally speaking, I say if it's over, you know, 4 to 6, then that could be something and kind of trick your memory into thinking, okay, like that could be something going on with this patient. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Is the age-related decline in fertility, should PCOS patients, so we had another podcast with Dr. Gustin just talking about infertility, but because their AMHs are high, right? They have lots of eggs still and they're anovulatory most of the time.
Yeah.
Do they see the same age-related decline or is age not as much a factor in PCOS?
They do, but they have a higher, probably a higher potential to have a pregnancy later in life. So like, and they probably have more treatment success in like 41, 42 year olds because I'm able to, like if we did IVF, I'm able to recruit significantly
more
eggs.
Their ovaries aren't shriveled up.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, they probably have a higher potential to have a pregnancy later on in life compared to an average person. But they still see the age-related decline as well as kind of when we see kind of egg quality and embryo quality is still worse in PCOS patients than in the average population.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so a patient has been given the diagnosis, they've met the criteria, they've maximized lifestyle interventions, they've lost 10% of their body weight. Can you talk about what the basic treatment looks like for somebody with PCOS?
So I think it's different whether or not you're, you know, it kind of depends on what you're treating, right? So if you want to do something where you're just, you know, trying to get yourself healthy and trying to kind of get your cycles more regular, you know, certainly I would say things like metformin are of benefit. And if you're not desiring fertility, and that is where like oral contraceptive pills come into play. If you're not cycling, and particularly if you're obese, and that is a hyperestrogenic state, and so you are predisposed to developing endometrial hyperplasia and cancer. And so, you know, that's the one caveat in patients is I say, listen, like, even if you're not trying to get pregnant, I don't think you need to have a period every month, but mm-hmm. I'd like you cyclically controlled enough that we're not putting you at risk. So that's how I would tailor it in somebody who, you know, is not trying to get pregnant, but wants like cycle control or management. If they're interested in like the androgenic side effects, so a lot of times we use medication like spironolactone, which helps with acne, especially like very cystic acne around the chin, and the T-zone. And the other medications that are highly anti-androgenic, I haven't used as frequently just because usually...
And we've got some new ones.
Yeah, there's some new ones, coming. But we'll see how they sort of come out. And then if you're trying to get pregnant, that's where ovulation induction, where remember how I talked about how it's like a loud bar. It's sort of like the medications are tailored to sort of wake your brain up and make sure that your brain understands that it's time to make an egg. And so my go-to frontline, first-line agent is letrozole, or it's an aromatase inhibitor. And the New England Journal of Medicine came out with an article, I think it was 2016, that basically said that, you know, letrozole was superior for ovulation induction compared to Clomid. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is still like the FDA has lagged behind. It's still not FDA kind of approved. Right. But we use it offline for a few days early on in the menstrual cycle to kind of help these patients ovulate more consistently.
Yeah. So it's called oral ovulation induction. So oral medications, Dr. Delaney mentioned letrozole. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was right during the middle of our training that really came out that showed there was higher live birth rates in patients with PCOS using letrozole versus clomiphene citrate or Clomid, which is what most people, you know, have heard about. And these are relatively cheap medications, readily available, given orally at a specific part of the menstrual cycle in the first part of the menstrual cycle to try to increase the FSH and LH secretion. So when she's talking about this bar analogy, it's like going from the loud party room in the bar to like the quaint little private area in the back where you mean business.
You're going to like, you're going to a private table with your glasses all there and your,
yeah. okay, but with oral ovulation induction and PCOS, there's some risks, especially with ovarian stimulation. Can you talk about those risks a little bit?
So, you know, the oral medications are good. You know, the goal is to make you ovulate. And, you know, the idea with kind of spontaneous menstrual cycles is that you ovulate one egg per month. But with these medications, sometimes you get super ovulation, so more than one egg. I would say that, you know, 8 to 10% of people with letrozole cycles get twins. And there's about a 1% chance of triplets, but I've certainly had them and they happen. And so, you know, I think if you're going to do that treatment, you need to sort of make sure that somebody has talked to you about that.
Yeah.
And in particular, if you have some of the other metabolic concerns and, you know, are at high risk for multiples, those are all things that, you know, I think any good REI or OBGYN is going to take in consideration whether or not you're going to do ovulation induction to try to make you make more than one like follicle, understanding that there's a potential risk for multiples or, you know, move on to something more invasive, but less chance of higher order multiples like IVF.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's stimulating the ovary. So a chance that you could release more than one egg. So when we talk about multiples, it's because it's release of more than one egg, right? not that it's making the egg, you know, split more often or something like that. So these aren't genetically identical, babies. They're, two sperm going into an egg or three or more. I mean, sometimes we've seen patients with PCOS type ovaries doing more aggressive, you know, ovarian stimulation that get higher order multiples. So definitely have to be cautious of that. Do you think that people with PCOS should always have ultrasound monitoring with oral ovulation induction, or can they do it more blindly? I mean, if they understand the risks, I guess.
Oh, that's a tough question. I think that I'm probably biased to
you
say
monitor
that,
everything.
So. Yeah, I know, right? I'm like, oh, I love having that information, but you know, I'm a data fiend, so I want to know the data. I think it's probably pretty reasonable to at least make sure, you know, maybe they need one cycle of like monitored so that you know that they're responding to the medication. I think more often than not, I see patients come to me that they said that they took Clomid, but then they never had a period and they had to have Provera. So essentially the Clomid or the letrozole didn't work. And so, you know, they come frustrated because they've done whatever their doctor said to do, but you know, I think it's probably most important to at least monitor one cycle, just so that you know that they're responding to the medication and you know whether they're hyper responding to the medicine. But I don't think it's probably necessary for two or three cycles. But I think the bigger thing is that, you know, when we're talking about ovulation induction, you know, I kind of give the rule of threes. If you've done three of something and it hasn't worked, you should step up your game. And so if you've done ovulation induction and done timed intercourse for two or three cycles and then unfortunately it hasn't been successful, then we need to talk about adding on intrauterine insemination. And if you've done that for three cycles, then we need to talk about, you know, moving on potentially with some gonadotropins, which we can talk about a little bit. But ultimately, I think this is, you know, infertility diagnosis and treatment is definitely a shared partnership between patient and physician. And so, you know, you want to make sure that you're having these conversations with your RE or your OBGYN.
Yeah. And to back up just on a couple things, when we were talking about like making the diagnosis, you know, ruling out things, male factor can't be ruled out too. You see
Absolutely.
This patient that we're like, oh my gosh, this is like straightforward PCOS. And then you do a semen analysis. We're like, oh, and there's bad sperm.
I had a dollar for every time.
Yeah, because there's so much more bad sperm these days. Yeah. Do you think it's all lifestyle? Like, what's your thoughts about, I feel like we just see more and more bad sperm.
I think it's a lot of things. I mean, I think there's a lot of things in our environment that affect male development, mm-hmm. Particularly, I mean, a lot of the plastics that, you know, all these phytoestrogens, I think that interferes a lot. I think part of it is diet. I think eating all of these things that sort of are fake and aren't really real food, I think that contributes to kind of some of that. You know, certainly sperm counts are just tanking as you and I age. And we don't even have the new standards. There should be new set standards because the WHO criteria was developed in like 96, and that's supposed to be like the fifth percentile, and you know, a lot of men are not fitting that profile. So,
This is totally off topic of PCOS, but I came across a study and I've been meaning to share it on socials, but, looking at underwear, and it was like the composition of the men's underwear, and it was polyester, and there was like decreased sperm counts, like more infertility in these men wearing like polyester underwear, and whether it's because it pulls the testicles closer, sure. But I believe they controlled for that in this study, and it was probably due to the polyester, like just like the phthalates or whatever the chemical is, just being so kind of close to the testicle.
Pseudoestrogens,
insane. Remember, your skin's your largest organ, so
yeah,
be careful what you put next to your testicles.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to back up on was when we were talking about women who maybe aren't ready to get pregnant, but they have this diagnosis of PCOS and kind of advice for them. You were talking about giving them, you know, intermittent progesterone to cycle them. I just wanted to dive into that a little bit because I find that patients don't really understand the risk of that.
Right.
So in a PCOS patient, you know, both her and I agree they should have a cycle like every 3 to 4 months to protect the endometrium. So what happens is that when you don't ovulate, when you don't release the egg, then you don't go through this progesterone phase and you're just continually stimulating the lining with estrogen. And not only when you do have a cycle, it will be this like ungodly, heavy, horrible cycle usually. But if you don't, that lining just builds and builds and builds. And her and I both have seen patients where they haven't had a period in like a year. And if they're obese, which also secretes more estrogen because our fat cells are not just latent, they're endocrine organs. And so they convert these androgens into more estrogen and more estrogen. And these patients are at risk for something called endometrial hyperplasia and eventually endometrial cancer, you know, if that goes uncontrolled. So PCOS patients definitely at a higher risk of estrogen related cancers if you don't keep that under control. So I just thought that was something we really needed to highlight. Yeah. So on that same note, patients who have PCOS and obesity, is there, you know, an upper weight limit, BMI limit, you know, that patients should really consider before like pursuing, you know, additional fertility treatment? Or
I think a lot of it depends on comorbidities. When I practiced at Mayo, we did have a BMI cutoff. We said if it was BMI of 45, if they had comorbidities, or a BMI of 40, if no comorbidities. We do not have a BMI cutoff at RHS at Methodist. And I appreciate that. There's actually been some new studies that have come out that generally speaking demonstrate that fertility in general is not dramatically affected by massive weight loss. And so I usually start, if my patients are really overweight and have significant comorbidities, in addition to sort of consultation with their primary OBGYN and perhaps a high-risk doctor, we talk about, you know, 10% body, you know, 10% weight loss over the next 6 months, and then pursuing treatment thereafter. And a lot of it depends on age. You know, if as they're aging and they're 38 or 39, they may not have the time to sort of, you know, really do as much.
You don't have 3 years to try to lose a bunch of weight.
Right. But, you know, certainly if they're morbidly obese and they have like many kind of secondary kind of metabolic factors, you know, these are people that if they're really young, then I say, you know, would you, if weight loss doesn't work, would you ever consider bariatric surgery?
Yeah. Well, and the reason I appreciate the conversation is because Dr. Delaney, from any ethical standpoint, could say, you know, I can help anybody get pregnant, but then what happens is she helps them get pregnant. And then, you know, after the first trimester, they come back to see me. And when you know, think about getting a woman pregnant who is obese, hypertensive, has type 2 diabetes, these are serious, legitimate risks, not only to her, but to her pregnancy and to the long-term health of her baby and herself. So these are just things that, you know, unfortunately, as doctors, you know, we enter every patient room in the most non-judgmental way possible. Yeah. But, you know, the data is data, and we want what's best for every patient. So you do have to kind of weigh all those individual factors. You know, what is your age? What do the labs look like? How much time do you have to really be aggressive about this before you're pregnant, because it's a huge issue for sure.
So I think I totally agree. And so I think my job as a reproductive endocrinologist is to sort of like lay, you know, expectations out. And, you know, I follow these patients closely over a period of like 6 to 8 months, and we see how we do with diet and weight loss. And, you know, if they've really gone to bat and done everything they can, then sort of in consultation with the other doctors that are going to be taking care of them, we sort of come up with a plan on what we feel like is going to be the best option for them. But, you know, and sometimes it is as invasive as bariatric surgery. Sometimes it's, you know, talk to Jamie and she's going to give you a diet plan based on kind of your metabolic parameters.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Talk about not even just PCOS patients, but just infertility patients in general. Like what role does like nutrition, dietary modifications play like in a patient's treatment?
You know, I wish that there was
like you need a staff nutritionist, well, and reproductive nutritionist in your office.
But I also wish that there was like a perfect diet for infertility, right? So like there just isn't, you know, they've done looking even, you know, there's subtle improvements with keto. There's, you know, when they've looked at everything, it's basically like the Mediterranean diet is best, which is a diet that's high in antioxidants. So what I generally tell patients is, you know, more than anything, you should be of a healthy weight. And as far as, you know, you should be doing enough exercise to maintain your health, but not so much exercise that you are completely losing any fat cells in your body. Because, you know, let's face it, the ovary is an estrogen producing factory. And, you know, all steroid hormones come from cholesterol, which ultimately is from fat. And so, you know, the ovary likes a little bit of excess fat. And so, you know, if you are doing too much exercise, that can sort of shut things off. And so I think, you know, everything in moderation, including moderation, right? So yeah. Like you have to sort of, you know, I tell my patients, you know, as far as nutrition, you know, stay towards the outside of the grocery store. Nothing good lives in the inside of the grocery store. Eat real food, you know, really focus on trying to eat things that are, you know, from the earth or from animals, like not that are just created by us.
Yeah. I think at the end of the day, you know, a whole food diet always wins. You know, the reason the Mediterranean diet always wins in research is because, and it's actually a very high fat diet, right? And fat's been like so vilified, but then everyone's like, oh, Mediterranean diet. Like you guys understand how much fat is in the Mediterranean diet. Yeah. Right. But like fish and olive oil and the carbs on a Mediterranean diet are very complex which the high fiber for, and you know, I could tell you debates on both sides as to like fiber is really not necessary, but the reason the fiber can be good for estrogen patients is, or for PCOS patients is because it can drive down estrogen. There's even studies on vegan diets that it drives the estrogen so low it causes infertility. So I mean, there, you know, I agree with Dr. Delaney. It's like if you can just eat real whole foods, and I tell patients this all the time, even patients that we're talking about ketogenic therapy. Listen, nobody got diabetes from blueberries and carrots. Okay, if you're stressing about the number of carbs you're eating because it's blueberries and carrots, like you're winning.
Yeah,
and so you've just got to get these processed foods. And the reason that they're so damaging is because there's no nutrients in them. Like you're consuming calories without the nutrients. So you're consuming these sugars and flours and vegetable oils. It's causing oxidation. It's causing inflammation. You're nutrient deficient. And so at the end of the day, figure out how to eat a nutrient dense diet.
Right.
And the only thing that'll work is what you'll actually do. So figure it out, you know, for yourself. But yeah, it's, I think, such a difficult thing for patients to
it's hard to practically tell that to somebody. I mean, I am the worst. I mean, Jamie knows me. I ate like garbage for the entire time of residency and even through part of fellowship. And then I felt like I needed to get healthy. And so really have, you know, started focusing on just eating like real food, you know?
I mean, Dr. Delaney drank about as much Diet Mountain Dew as I ate Oreo chocolate pudding in the hospital UNMC C store. Nobody's perfect. Okay. Let's just talk about a couple other treatment options out there that people have asked about for PCOS. Talk to me about ovarian drilling, such kind of like an old school thing, but does that work? What's the evidence show?
Okay, so I have used ovarian drilling once, count it one time. It really does work for the hyperandrogenic.
Can you describe what it is? Because somebody's thinking about a power drill right now at home.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, no. So there's two different kinds. So there's something called a wedge resection. A wedge resection is where you basically go in and you remove part of the ovary. Remember how Jamie and I were talking about how the ovaries in PCOS patients are larger? Well, the idea is if you cut down on the volume, you cut down on all the extra hormones, all that extra noise. Remember in that loud bar?
The bouncer's pulling like 20 people out of the bar, okay? Yeah. The rowdiest
ones. Overcrowded. Okay. The problem with that is that, you know, anytime that you do a wedge resection, it is a highly, highly like adhesion surgery. So what I see in patients that have had this wedge resection is that, you know, a physician went in with very good intentions to try to, you know, decrease or get them pregnant, and now their tubes are blocked. And they're blocked because, you know, unfortunately, anytime you sort of touch the ovary with anything, it is just a, it's just a nidus for sort of scar tissue to form. And so that sort of went the way of the, you know, the dodo bird, as you say, because people realized it was causing inflammation and it was causing scar tissue, and medications like Clomid and Letrozole are better. So then people came up with this idea, well, maybe we can get away from wedge resection if we do something called diathermy. And that is basically where we burn little holes in your uterus. So that is like the, or in your ovary. But that is sort of the classic ovarian drilling. So you take basically cautery and you make holes in the ovary. But again, it really is one of those things where it is, you know, adhesion forming. Mm-hmm. And so I really don't like it in fertility patients. Yeah. I think that it should be used in patients that have, you know, hyperandrogenism that is so severe, and it's like hyperthecosis, like mm-hmm. the ovary is gigantic and is secreting all of this testosterone and all of these things, and we've tried everything and they still have, you know, a beard, and they still have things, and we've ruled out every kind of tumor and everything like that. And so in general, that's the way that I would reserve that.
Yeah. Okay. Never drilled an ovary in my life. I mean, I've operated on ovaries, but not on purpose, but I do hot needles in my face and it does wonders for my face. So hot needles for the ovary. Okay. We talked a little bit about metformin and, you know, medications that can help with insulin sensitization. And I took metformin. I was able to start ovulating again alone, but I think the studies really show that metformin plus metformin with Clomid, that it's, there's not.
So it's usually, if you're doing it for non-fertility purposes, again, like Jamie and I were saying, do something where you're either on a birth control or you're on like every 3 to 4 month Prefera withdrawal. So you're having a regular kind of withdrawal bleed every few months. And then if you're trying to get pregnant, generally speaking, metformin plus letrozole is kind of superior than metformin alone.
Yeah. I mean, my preference in patients that aren't trying to get pregnant, and this is just me speaking to you guys out of my own clinical experience, I love levonorgestrel IUDs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, definitely biased towards progestin implants just because it's great. It protects the endometrium. A lot of times they don't have periods while they work aggressively on, you know, IUDs on lifestyle, you know, interventions and things like that, because I just feel like the extra burden of the ethanol estradiol sometimes is just, and that's, we kind of touched on it. There are some new classes of birth controls and things like that coming out. A new progesterone-only one that's drospirenone, which has some anti-androgenic effects. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, of course, with all these new meds battling with insurance companies is like beating your head against a wall. So more to come on that. But okay, so back to the kind of the hirsutism, because that's a very distressing thing for women. Yeah. Laser hair removal.
Yeah.
Definitely a great option, you know, for people.
And I usually tell people if spironolactone doesn't work, and this is just speaking clinically, yes, there are other medications like flutamide that you can try. Like there's like
finasteride.
There's all these other medications, but clinically they don't make that much of a difference. Mm-hmm. And so what I tell people is if spironolactone, if you sort of hit your wall, then you're going to visit your friendly dermatologist and we're going to do kind of laser hair removal. We could have Dr. Orlieb come in and
I invited her on. She's like building a new building or something right now, but we're going to have this wonderful dermatologist, come in too. And we're going to talk about hair and hair loss. Cause it's like, get asked about it all the time.
And so I just tell people like, that's when I think we have to get like cosmetic dermatology on board because it just works better. It looks better. And there's less side effects. There's less renal side effects. A lot of these medications are secreted by the kidney. And so, you know, you just want to.
Well, you don't want to get pregnant on these.
Exactly.
Spironolactone. Like that's the thing is like if you're going to take an anti-androgen medication like spironolactone, you have to have birth control.
Yes.
So you don't want to have an unplanned pregnancy.
Right.
And if they're working on lifestyle interventions, they will like they'll get pregnant. Like, trust me.
Yeah.
Sometimes very quickly. So
definitely
something to consider. Okay, so we've talked about some of the adjuvant therapies for the hirsutism, and so that's such an important thing. What else did we miss on PCOS? Anything you can think of that patients need to know about? PCOS Awareness Month in September, you guys.
Yes. So I would just sort of like, you know, make sure that people know, like I said, that, you know, it's so common. I feel like, I mean, it's, I think Megan, my partner, and I were talking about how I think it's like 40 to 50% of our patients. And, you know, talk to your doctor. You know, we see this all the time. You know, this isn't something that you should like suffer in silence about.
Yeah.
And nor is it something that, you know, you should be afraid to like reach out and speak to someone about like how to improve things. And if you need help with fertility, you know, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. There's treatment options. Yeah. So don't suffer in silence. Talk to your provider and get some help. Don't talk to your friends. Don't ask for advice on social media. Okay, so at the end of all my podcasts, I do something called the semen analysis.
Okay.
Which is just, you know, I'll talk about a study, but I want to talk about specifically because I live in the low-carb arena, which I think can be so helpful for patients with PCOS. So I pulled some of the data and I just want to kind of highlight it for people. So, you know, they say PCOS is 10% of childbearing women, but I don't know. Dr. Delaney and I both agree.
I don't think
it's so much more common amongst women of childbearing age. And I just feel like with the increase in metabolic disease that we've seen in the world, we just see more patients with kind of this PCOS phenotype. So I just want to review. So problems with menstruation, they can have physical symptoms. It's the leading cause of infertility. And unfortunately, I don't think the lifestyle intervention is given as an option to a lot of these patients. I think that's the unfortunate part. And it's not that I don't think that my colleagues care about people. I just think that as doctors, like that's not like how we were trained as like first steps. And so I think that's where patients kind of get lost. So there's nobody like quarterbacking that. And that is one good thing about social media is it's allowed. There's some great like PCOS awareness societies that can give patients really good information about that. But definitely these patients have higher rates of type 2 diabetes and gestational diabetes. So I think lifestyle intervention is so important, as well as knowing what your blood pressure is, what your cholesterol is and all of this. But I just want to highlight low carbon ketogenic therapies for PCOS because, I've had such great success with it in my clinic, helping patients achieve pregnancy, either just with lifestyle intervention or with oral ovulation induction. So no offense, Dr. Delaney, but I try not to send all the patients over there. She's very nice about sending them back. But okay, a study in 2005, it was only 11 women. That's the thing about these trials is they're like tiny little trials. But 11 women with PCOS, they went on a ketogenic diet for 6 months. 5 women who completed the study lost weight. Their hormonal status all improved. Decrease in perception of body hair. And 2 of the women actually became pregnant during the study, even though all 11 patients had previous problems with infertility. And then a 2013 study found that even a modest reduction in carbohydrates, which was 41% of calories, which most ketogenic diets are less than 10% of calories. So I think this even just highlights that if you're eating 60% of your calories from carbs, even if you can just cut that back a little bit, right? And it's probably cutting out like beverages that have sugar, juices, like just those simple carbohydrates. And this 2013 study led to significant improvements in weight, hormones, and risk factors for PCOS. And then a 2017 review of clinical trials found that low-carb diets reduce circulating insulin levels, improve the hormonal imbalance, and resume ovulation to improve pregnancy rates. And then a 2019 meta-analysis of all the RCTs basically found the same thing. And they just said proper control of carbohydrate intake provides beneficial effects on some aspects of PCOS and may represent one of the most important interventions for improving clinical symptoms for these patients. And then in 2020, I'm glad people are still researching this because we're just seeing more and more women. There was 14 women with PCOS. They did a Mediterranean diet, like we talked about, for 12 weeks. By the end of the study, they had lower blood glucose, lower blood insulin, improved their reproductive hormone levels, function, a reduction in all heart disease risk factors, and an average weight loss of 20 pounds. So, and that was 12 weeks. So, I mean, when we talk about like, gosh, this woman's old, she doesn't have time. 12 weeks. Like it's probably going to take you 12 weeks just to get through all your testing, right? Like it's never too late to just start.
Like I said, I mean, like pretty much anybody I start metformin on, I tell them like, here's the deal. You have insulin resistance. We've got to like lay off the glucose. So I generally tell people low carb, high protein diets immediately on starting that medication. So I use it. I think it's important. I think it's the best way for PCOS women to lose some weight.
Yeah. And it's totally safe. Whatever diet helps you get pregnant is the diet that you can continue in pregnancy. Because, you know, basically at any given moment, your body is surveying the environment to say, is this a good time to reproduce? So if you're able to reproduce, it's giving you that go ahead. And, you know, whatever healthy things you're doing, if you're exercising, we want you to continue that. If you get pregnant, you know, continue your healthy diet. you know, work with your REI doctor and your OBGYN. And it's just, it's so important for the long-term outcomes for yourself and for your baby too. So awesome. All right. That's the semen analysis for today. Such a fitting topic to have Dr. Delaney on and do the semen analysis. So thank you guys so much for listening to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. Make sure you share this with all your friends because PCOS is so common. Share this with a woman in your life that you feel like it's going to help. Leave all your comments and questions over on our YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and leave us your reviews. We appreciate you guys so much. Have a good day. Thanks, Dr. Delaney.